Rabbis, family, and friends. I also just want to say a special welcome to Rabbi Hirt, our interim rabbi last year, who together with Esty were wonderful leaders in our shul. Our scholar today is someone the shul knows very well and who I will introduce shortly, Rabbi Mark Wilds. Before I get to that point, I need to express Hakarat HaTov, thanks to all those people who helped make this event a success. Susie Lieberman, thank you again for arranging the tables, always available to consult on various issues relating to this program. As usual, although you don't see Jonathan Hertz has worked behind the scenes to make sure that the event went off seamlessly. Thank you, Zev, our chairman of the board, for assisting in taping the event. Thank you to Herb Schoenout, who arranged for the posting of some Rabbi Grumblatt-related memorials in the auditorium, including Rabbi Wild's moving, in essence, hespede for Rav Grumblatt days after he was niftar. Copies are on the tables and also on the wall. I'll be referencing that later. I want to thank our president, Doug Aronin, continuing to do his amazing job of contributing wherever needed. Thank you to our wonderful new rabbi, Judah Kerbel, and his wife, Eliana, for all of their hard work, caring, devotion, and their sheer goodness. And again, I will get in trouble for this, but thank you again to my wonderful wife, Amy, for helping any way that she could, and for some reason, hanging around with me. Thank you to the caterer, Main Street Bagel, and to Uri Amar. And of course, tremendous thanks to Mario and Lorraine for all the incredible work they do day after day with an attention to detail, with love and devotion to the QJC. Thank you very much. Thank you to Miriam for all her hard work in getting everything together, including the flyer, notifications, publicity, processing, reservations, so many other things, and having to listen to many people barking orders at her. Thank you to Margie. Thank you to our Mashkiach. Thank you to all the sponsors. As you can see, we have a very, very nice crowd. This is the largest crowd we've had in over 3 years, and a lot of sponsors who stepped up to help to make this program what it is today. I want, of course, welcome the entire Grumblatt family. It makes us feel so good, Rebbetzin, to see you here with us. You look so wonderful. We miss you, but we're so happy to know that you're with your family. Such a loving environment. I also want to thank Hen and David Grunblatt, Chana and Rabbi Akiva Grunblatt, Hillel and Mashi Tendler, and Rabbi Dov Osina and Sarah Osina for joining us today. Thank you so much for making this such a wonderful event. I said this year after year, but it bears repeating year after year. I have to say thanks to the Grunblatt and Tendler family because that's who I communicate with. I communicated this year with Hillel and David and, of course, the Rebbetzin. And, again, just there to help in any way that they could, making zero demands and always saying, what can we do to make this easier on you? Thank you to this wonderful, wonderful family. The testament to that love and affection and respect that the community feels for the Grunblatt family, again, is exemplified by the people who showed up today. As I said, every single year, but it bears repeating, no one has to convince anybody to show up here. Everybody comes with a full heart. I should also tell you, strangely, we had a lot of people who actually signed up early, which is an anathema to this shul and to most shuls, which again just shows you again the feeling that the community has for the Grunblatt family. We've been so fortunate to have had such wonderful rabbis succeed Rav Grunblatt Zatzal, and I don't think that's a coincidence. Rav Grunblatt will always be a part of this shul, and you can feel his presence each day in the sanctuary. So all that those that occupy that bima, I think, feel and share that kedusha. I'm going to take a sports metaphor, because I know the rabbi liked sports metaphors. He's probably not going to like the actual analogy. But growing up as a Yankee fan, we always referred to Yankee Stadium as the house that Ruth built. Babe Ruth being that superstar player for the Yankees, who played many, many years ago. I think I could say very, very simply that QJC is the shul that Rav Grunblatt built. If you say the word, the Queens Jewish Center today, the first words out of any person's mouth will say, oh, Rav Grunblatt shul. So I think that our current rabbi, Rabbi Kerbel and Eliana, together, who've been here with us only a short time, but have impressed us with their scholarship, sincerity, genuineness, decency, modesty, hard work, and devotion. And I'm going to introduce Rabbi Kerbel just to say a few words.
Morning. Shister Edmondson and the Mishpacha. I want to echo all the thank yous that David said without repeating everything, but I do want to note my Hakar Satov to everyone who helped make this happen. Everybody in this room pretty much knew Rabbi Grunblatt better than I did, because I never had the schluss to meet him. But if I can just take a few moments, I'll share a few reflections that I think loosely connects to Rabbi Weil's topic and Rabbi Grunblatt's Atzal. There's a phenomena in the firm world of hanging pictures of Gedolei Torah in people's homes. In Chabad families, it's usually the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Atzal, could be the Chafetz Chaim or Moshe Feinstein, current Gedolim, Chacham Avadia Yosef. But then there's a part of our world, generally more modern world, that chafes a little bit at this phenomenon, maybe because of an over-idealizing of Das Torah and Gedolim. And I'm not going to say that everybody should go home and hang up pictures of Gedolim in their homes. But what does concern me a little bit sometimes is that it's cool if you have a picture, if you're 15 years old, you have a picture of LeBron James and Taylor Swift in your bedroom. But chas v'shalom, to ever hang up a picture of a rabbi in your house, that's too frum. And what makes me think about this morning is that when I walked into the rabbi's office at QJC, there was a picture that was hanging up of Rabbi Grunblatt. And I've since hung up a couple pictures of some of my own rabbis, but that picture of Rabbi Grunblatt is facing me when I sit in the chair. It's the first thing I see when I look at the wall. And didn't have the exclusive meeting Rabbi Grunblatt, but I know that I am a dwarf on the shoulders of a giant, walking in his footsteps, very humbled by what I know to have been his scholarship, his humility, his dignity. And it's something when I think about, I'm very humbled to be the Rav of the Shul after him. And when I look at that picture, it gives me a lot of inspiration, it humbles me, and I feel, of course, very sad that I didn't have the opportunity to meet him, but it gives me a lot of chizuk that everybody is here this morning to pay kavod to somebody who served the Shul for so many decades with much devotion, with love for Klal Yisrael, and I want to thank everybody for being here to mark the Yahrzeit Rabbi Grunblatt Zatzal.
As I said before, this is our fifth annual Yahrzeit lecture, and we have had various scholars. In our first, we had Rav Schechter, whose reputation as a supreme scholar in Talmud Chacham is renowned. That was followed by Dr. David Pelkovitz, impressive psychologist and educator. We had Alan Fagan, one of the foremost attorneys in the United States, and the executive vice president and chief professional officer of the OU. And last year, with the honor of hearing Rabbi Akiva Grunblatt, son of Rav Joseph Grunblatt, and a scholar in his own right. What each of these scholars had in common was their respect, love, and strong connection with the Grunblatt family, and particularly with Rav Grunblatt Zatzal, that made their already outstanding presentations particularly genuine and authentic. It also reflected Rav Grunblatt's amazing ability to touch so many people covering the spectrum of Am Yisrael. Today's scholar, Rabbi Mark Wild is a further addition to this Mesorah. He grew up in QJC and had a very close relationship with Rabbi Grunblatt. But there's no need for me for you to take my word for it. Here are some of Rabbi Wild's own words from that moving tribute that he wrote only 4 days after Rav Grunblatt was niftar. The full version is posted in the lobby and on your tables. Quote, "The impact of this great rabbinic figure had on my life is almost impossible to put into words. Rabbi Grunblatt was my rabbi since the very day I was born. He assumed the position as rabbi of QJC, where I am from, shortly before I was born in July of 1967. As he always liked to say, my bris was the first simcha in the community at which he officiated. He was similarly there for me at my bar mitzvah, my rabbinic ordination, my wedding, my mother's funeral, and all of my son's britot. Rabbi Grunblatt was a rare combination of Yirat Shemayim and profound religiosity on the one hand and intellectual openness on the other. I always knew it was a rare privilege to be mentored by such an erudite scholar, but what was even more special was his sense of chesed, of kindness, concern, which he displayed for all people and in particular his congregants. I was truly blessed to have Rabbi Grunblatt in my life. Every class I teach, every sermon I deliver, and every question I try to answer has and will always be informed by what this great rabbi taught me. And so he truly does live on. Rabbi Wilds is the founder and director of Manhattan Jewish Experience, a highly successful Jewish outreach and educational program that engages and reconnects unaffiliated Jewish men and women in their 20s and 30s with Judaism and the Jewish community. As an aside, one of those couples is here today. He also teaches a Kirov training seminar at REITs and is the author of the highly acclaimed Beyond the Instant, Jewish Wisdom for Lasting Happiness in a Fast-Paced Social Media World. After serving in rabbinic and outreach positions at QJC, Oab Tzedek in Kilat Cheshren, and teaching at Ramaz and Stern College, Rabbi Wilds established MJE and has reconnected thousands with Judaism, hundreds of whom are today living committed Jewish lives and sending their children to yeshivot and Jewish day schools. MJE's many programs and trips to Israel provided a venue through which 322 Jewish couples have married. And thus, we established yet another kesher with Rav Grunblatt, Kiruv. As we all are well aware, Rav Grunblatt and his first wife, the late Esther Grunblatt, were active in the resettlement in Queens of immigrants from the former Soviet Union. Rabbi Wald's topic tonight is the fading American Jew and the Torah's imperative of Kiruv. Let us give Rabbi Wald a warm welcome.
I tripped when I spoke here the last time, which was my afrof, which took place in this very hall. Bershusamar Da'asra, Rabbi Korbel, and Bershus Rabbi Akiva Grunblatt, David, Revitzin Bella Grunblatt, Rabbi Gold. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be able to share some words of Torah in memory of my beloved Rebbe, Rabbi Grunblatt Zichrono Livracha. You heard just a little excerpt about the extraordinary impact that he had on my life, both personal and professional. It's just a rush of extraordinary nostalgia. I would say that Rabbi Grunblatt went from being my rabbi to my Rebbe when I finally realized that I probably should stop running out of shul before he got up to speak and run down to this room. I see Mrs. Grossman. I used to run down to play with Richie, Avery Fisher, and Sammy Reichel. We crunched up all these cups and would play hockey here every Saturday morning. Rabbi Grunblatt would wax so eloquent upstairs, And when I got a little older, my dad, Yibadel Chaim, and my father and my brother, who unfortunately couldn't be here, really wanted to be here, send their very, very best and their love to the Grunblatts. And my dad prevailed on me to stay and said, listen, Mark, you gotta just stay for a few minutes. I was in high school. And I started to realize what I was missing. And this rabbi who, as you heard, was there at my bris, who handed me the famous book that he would hand all bar mitzvah boys from Rabbi Maris Max, Zichrono Livracha, at my bar mitzvah. And he came to my Chag HaSmicha at Yeshiva University, and I was very touched that he came and was Masada Kedushin at my wedding. And I'll never forget the piece of Torah he said under the chuppah and gave such chizuk to my mother, who passed away just a few months afterwards and was maspid her at her levaya. And he came to all of my son's brises. And when I got back from my year in Israel, I would always make sure to be there for the drushas on Shabbos morning. And I actually started writing down the rabbi's Torah on Motzei Shabbos so I wouldn't forget. And I began religiously attending all of his shiurim, wherever I could find them. And I was in YU, and I remember at the time I was really not going to enter the rabbinate. I was just in YU to learn, and I was studying to be a lawyer to go into the firm. And YU, they don't like you floating around too much. So you have to be in a program. So they used to have this Chavir program. I finished that. And then I joined the Smicha program, not to be a rabbi, but just because I wanted to stay with my Rebbe, Reb Parnas, Yibadel Chaim. And one of my other rabbis said, why don't you just finish it? And I said, to finish Smicha at YU, you got to do a shimush, like an apprenticeship. And there you have to start working in the rabbinate. I'm not interested. I was just interested in learning, continuing my learning. But he said, you know, you never know. It's nice to have the degree. Fine. What am I going to do for my shimush? So I had been involved with NCSY. Those of you know, I used to play in this room, the drums. That's how I got the gig at NCSY. I played in a band for through college and graduate school. And I loved doing Kirov. And was always on the high school level. And somebody said to me, you know, you could start doing a little outreach in your community in Forest Hills. Why don't you start a beginner service at the Queen's Jewish Center? And I really had never heard of a beginner service. And I found a videotape. I think it was like Betamax. I'm really dating myself. I watched Rabbi Buchwald run a beginner service for 3 hours, and I was hooked. I just loved it. And I called Rabbi Grunblatt up, and I asked, could I start a beginner service here at the Queen's Jewish Center? And you would have to officially be my mentor in order for me to get the Shemush credit up at YU. And he said, yes. And I plastered the neighborhood with flyers. I went to my dad. I asked him if he'd give me the money for an ad in the Queen's Tribune and Yellowstone Boulevard, 108th Street, and Queens Boulevard was filled with these flyers, and 8 people showed up. It was exactly right beyond where these walls are, on the other room where the Hashkama Minyan met. And when the Hashkama Minyan was finished, I would quickly turn the room around, take the mechitza that was in the back and put it in the middle and just move things around so it would work. And 8 people showed up. And I was like a little despondent. 8 people, I did all this marketing. And Rabbi Grunblatt said, 8 is good, Mark. Those are 8 students. Take them seriously. And he would come in almost every Shabbos to say a little word of Torah at the end. It didn't matter how many people were there. It could be 6 people, it could be 8 people. And it grew. 15 people, 20 people, 30 people. And he then served as my guest lecturer. It was time to start a class. During the week, I started a basic Judaism course on Thursday nights. And I taught it for 8 weeks, and then Rabbi Grimblatt would come in and do a guest lecture after the 8 weeks were over. I did that for 3 years with him. He taught me how to kosher a kitchen, and he answered my endless halachic questions. And I'll just share one story, and it's in the article there, because it really just so much captures how special he was, how unique. So I had this one student, and I'll never forget, Vladimir Nyman, PhD from University of Leningrad. I was 23, 24. He was like 32, 33. And he was a genius. He was just scientific. He had a PhD in mathematics, and he was a scientist. And he believed in nothing that could not be proven in a laboratory. And every Shabbos, he'd get up and ask a question, and he would stand on his... It was like a press conference, and he used to really intimidate me. And I had to somehow reconcile every problem in the Bible and science, and I did the best I could. And at some point I said, Vladimir, you know, there's a great scholar in this community. It might be worthwhile for you to sit down with Rabbi Grimblatt. And I asked Rabbi Grimblatt if he would meet with Vladimir, and he did. And the rabbi called me up after the meeting, and he said, Mark, you know, you're making a lot of progress with Vladimir. I said, progress? He doesn't believe in anything. What progress? He just stumps me every Shabbos at the minyan. He says, no, you don't understand. Vladimir said to me that before he started coming to the Queens Jewish Center beginner service, he thought that anyone who believed in God was a fool. Opiate of the masses. He says, now, the rabbi said to me, he still doesn't believe in God. But now, he says, he believes that there are intelligent people who do. And he said, that's step one. And I'm convinced to this day that he only made that comment after he met with Rabbi Grimblatt. And he was very, very special. And I attribute whatever I'm able to do and the Torah that I'm able to teach. MGE is now 21 years old. And I would not have gone into this if it wasn't for Rabbi Grimblatt. I would not have had the vision of what it really means to be a Rav, of what it really means to care. And even if you are, as Rabbi Grimblatt was, in such a high, you know, spiritual and Torah level, and taught such profound Torah and philosophy, that you could be concerned and need to be concerned for every Jew, irrespective of how distant they might be from Yiddishkeit. And so it's very, very appropriate that I would be able to share some words of Torah in the rabbi's memory, and in particular, Torah on Kiruv, which is the area of the rabbinate, as you hear, that he mentored me and encouraged me to enter. So I want to begin with a story that I've shared many times, which really continues to inspire me in my outreach work. And this is a story I heard from a friend of mine who was a rabbi in a small out-of-town shul. It's a little comical, but it's true. And there was a gentleman, a middle-aged gentleman by the name of Harry. He used to sit in the back of the shul, minded his own business. And he would come to Shabbos, to the minyan every week, and he would sit in the back, and without fail, the gabbai would offer Harry some kibud, an aliyah, psicha, Hagba, Glila, and without fail, Harry would turn him down. Harry had no background in Judaism, and he was way too embarrassed to do anything too Jewish in public. But the Gabbai was persistent. And the Gabbai said, listen, Harry, we're a small community. There's got to be some honor that I can bestow upon you. And he thought to himself, he says, you know, at the end of the Torah reading, there's always somebody that gets up and lifts the Torah in the air. And the Gabbai says, yeah, yeah, Hagba. He says, well, there's always somebody else who rolls it. He says, that's called Galila. He says, yeah, if you get somebody to teach me how to do that, I'll do the Galila. So the Gabbai gets together with Harry during the week, and he teaches him how to do Galila. Three steps. You roll the Torah, put the bendel around it, put the mantle on top. Pretty simple. And all week long, he's memorizing the three steps, and he's practicing. And the next Shabbos, Yamdu HaMagbiya VaHagolel, and Harry comes up, and he is nervous. His heart's going pitter-patter. He's like been practicing all week. And the gentleman who is Hagba lifts it high in the air, steps up onto the bima, is a little elevated, and he starts the three steps, and he rolls the Torah, he puts the bendel around the Torah, and he puts the mantle on top, and he breathes a huge sigh of relief, and he's about to step down, feeling really good about himself, and the gabbai is there, and he hands Harry a crown, silver crown. And Harry's just holding the crown. He's frozen. He has no idea what to do with it. Nobody said anything about a crown. He did his three steps. He's done. The gabbai is getting a little awkward. He whispers. He says, Harry, put it on. So, and he's just standing. He's not really sure what to do. The guy who's holding the Torah is like, you know, it's getting heavy. He's like, Harry, put it on. So you know where this is going. Takes the silver atara, and he puts it on his head, gets back up on the bima, and he starts walking around the bima, does a little circle with the crown of Torah on his head, and everybody has a good laugh. The next Shabbos, my friend who is the rabbi of the shul, this is real, says, you know, last Shabbos we all had a nice laugh at Harry's expense, but the truth is, if anyone in this shul deserves to wear a crown of Torah on his head, it's Harry. And he pulls out the Rambam, one of the most beautiful passages in the Mishnah Torah. In Hilchos Talmud Torah, the Rambam says, "V'shlosha k'tarim nichturu Yisrael," that there are three crowns that the Jewish people have been crowned with. Keter Torah, Keter Kahuna, the Keter Malchus. And the Rambam continues to say that whereas the Keter Kahuna, the crown of priesthood, can only be worn by Aaron and his descendants, and Keter Malchus Zacha Bo David, only King David and his descendants can wear, when it comes to the Keter of Torah, Hare Munach Ve'omed Umuchan L'chol Yisrael, says the Rambam. It is prepared, it is standing, it is ready for all of Israel. Kol Mi Sheyirtze, anyone who wants it, Yavo V'yitol, can come and take it. Kol Mi Sheyirtze, we live in a generation in which thousands of men and women who were not raised with much Yiddishkeit have come and made Torah their own. And we know this. This shouldn't be surprising to us because we know that commitment to Yahdut and even leadership in Judaism is not something which is inherited. It's not something because my parents did this, therefore I do this. But it's rather something which is merited by anyone who wants it. We know the famous teaching, one of the things we teach our children, Torah Tziva Alana Moshe Morasha Ki Yilas Yaakov, and the Gemara teaches that you should not read it Morasha, that it is an inheritance, but Ela Me'urasa, that Judaism is not a simple inheritance that passes from generation to generation, but it is something that you fall in love with. It's Kol Mi Sheyirtze, anyone who wants it, Yavo Vito. And there's no episode in the Torah that illustrates this more dramatically than the succession of Jewish leadership from Moshe Rabbeinu to, not to Moshe Rabbeinu's own sons, but to Yehoshua ben Nun. And many of the Mefarshim ask that question, why is it that Moshe's own children do not succeed their father's exalted position of leadership? And there's a fascinating Medrash which quotes a conversation between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe in responding to Moshe's implicit request that his own children succeed him. This is, by the way, in Parshas Pinchas and my Bar Mitzvah. Also, it was my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, and I made one mistake upstairs in the main shul on my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, and it was the Aliyah that Rabbi Grunblatt had, which was upsetting. But he whispered into my ear the correct pronunciation of the word. He didn't yell it out. He just whispered it into my ear, and I made the change. And the only one who seemed to know was him, so not everybody else knows. But the Medrash says that, this is Parshas Pinchas, that after Benos Tzlavchad came to Moshe, and he said, it's not fair. Avinu Beis Bamidbar, our father is past, And we're not going to have a nachla in the land of Israel. And Moshe brought this to Hashem. And Hashem said, Kein benot slavcha delvrot. And they were given what they asked for. And the Medrash says that at that time, Moshe realized it was an opportune time to ask Hashem for his request, that his own children succeed him. And the Medrash quotes a pasuk from Sefer Mishlei, Yotzer te'ena yochel priyah. Very, very powerful Medrash. Whoever keeps the fig tree will eat of its fruit. Listen to what Hashem says to Moshe in the Medrash. Banecha yashvu lehem v'lo asku b'torah. And this is a little harsh. Hashem says to Moshe, your sons sat. And when he says sat, it's like they sat. They weren't occupied. V'lo asku b'torah. Yehoshua, however, harbe sharatcha, he ministered to you greatly. V'harbe chalak lecha kavod. He was the one to show you great honor. He was the one to get up early in the morning and stay up late at night in the Ol Moed. Hu haya masader to Sav Salim. He was the one to arrange the benches. Vuhu paresa to machtlaot and to spread out the mats. Hoel vuhu sharatcha b'chol kocho. Because he was the one that ministered to you with all of his might. Kedai hu shi shamesh et Israel. It is worthy for Yehoshua to be the next leader of Israel. And the Medrash concludes with the same way it opened, quoting that pasuk from Mishlei, Notzer te'ena, whoever keeps the fig tree, yochal periyah, will eat of its fruit. Right? Judaism is not a little boys' club. It goes, and its leadership goes to whoever deserves it and merits it through their own efforts. The Gemara asks why the children of Torah scholars do not always turn out to be Torah scholars themselves. To which Rav Yosef in the Gemara responds, Shelo Yomru, Torah Yerusha Hilachem. So nobody should say, of course he's a Talmud Chacham, look at his father. And if every Talmud Chacham's son turned out to be like their parent, then he would just say, of course, that's the way it is. And it's amazing to come from wonderful Yichus. You know, when we make a big deal, my grandfather was this, my grandfather came from here. But at the end of the day, we know we're not evaluated by our ancestry. And we are not measured by our family lineage, but rather by our actions. And that's why some of the greatest leaders of Israel, whether it was Rut HaMoaviyah, whether it's Unklus, can't open up a Chumash to this day without seeing Targum Unklus, and both of whom were Gerim, converted to Judaism, or Rabbi Akiva, who only began to learn Torah at the age of 40. These greats became our leaders and our heroes, not because of who their parents were, and not because of where they came from, but because of who they became on their own. And I remember many years ago, when MG first started, there was a young man, he was living in Brooklyn at the time, was in medical school, and he came to the Upper West Side to meet a friend for lunch. Saturday, we were going to go out for brunch. He told me this whole story. And as he's walking by West 86th Street, where MGE has its headquarters, we're based at the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side, his phone goes off. His friend calls him, cancels their plans. I still don't know why. I'm very happy, though. You'll hear in a moment. And here he is walking literally by our center, and I worked very hard to get that sign posted, you know. Signage is very important in my business. And 86th Street is, you know, good real estate. And he's walking by the sign, and he's got nothing to do. His friend just canceled plans, and there's a big thing, MGE beginner service. And he walks in. He, by accident, goes to the third floor, which is the main synagogue, and he's wearing, like, jeans and a T-shirt. And somebody, you know, holding the sitter upside down, he had no idea what was going on. So somebody brought him up to the 10th floor where MGE is based. And something clicked. And he came back the next Shabbos. And then he took our beginner's Judaism class and started to learn how to read Hebrew. And he came to Israel for the first time in his life. He traveled with us. We take two groups to Israel every summer. And little by little, his name is Larry Flisser. He's back in Brooklyn. But he's living as a religious Jew. And although he received no formal Jewish education, and just 2 years earlier had been engaged to his non-Jewish girlfriend, which shouldn't shock anyone, because that's unfortunately the trajectory today. Just be aware, when we talk about a 58% intermarriage rate in the Jewish community, that includes the entire Orthodox community. If you pull the Orthodox community out of the number, it rises to 71%. This is the matzav in which we find ourselves. But Larry, today, is an involved, learned, and observant Jew. And I was just speaking last week with another one of my students, Jonathan Udrin, who's now Yonatan Udrin, who over 15 years ago came on one of our early trips to Israel. First time he'd ever been there. And his mitzvah, and I really believe this, with every Jew who comes back, there's that special mitzvah, that special connection. And he came back, and he was just so drawn to Yiddishkeit. And he learned with us for a while, and eventually went back to Eretz Yisrael, and studied in yeshiva for 7-8 years, and eventually got smicha. And today, he is an outreach director at Hebrew University, doing basically what I've been doing for the last 20 years. He's been doing it for the last 10 years, 8-9 years, really. And it's unbelievable, because he also was involved in a very serious relationship with someone not of the faith. And now he's a teacher of Torah, living in Eretz Yisrael, his wife and 5 kids. And it's all because in Judaism you don't have to come from a certain family in order to pursue a life of Torah. You don't need yichus to count. You just need a passion and a desire to incorporate Torah into your life. Kol mi sheyirtza yavo v'yitol. But there's an even deeper and a little more of a selfish reason for being involved in this holy work. And that is, I think, what we can get out of this. And that is the inspiration that I think the Orthodox community is in so desperate need of, that we can often access from dealing with Baalei Tshuva, or people who may not end up fully observant, but are on some kind of path. Years ago, I heard a story, and then, Jessica, if you want to do me a favor, the folder right beside you is a source sheet, and I forgot to give it out. It's just a little piece of Torah that I want to share after this story. But I heard this story from Rabbi Adin Steinzeltz many years ago. And I figured it was appropriate to share. Rabbi, it's a story about Hanukkah that I thought I would just share. And I don't know, maybe this will change the way you light your menorah this year. And Rabbi Steinzeltz said that it was the first year since the passing of his grandfather. And he and his grandmother were together for Hanukkah. And Rabbi Steinzeltz lit the menorah. And out of the corner of his eye, he noticed his grandmother looking a little sad. And he naturally assumed, because his grandfather had passed away, that his grandmother was upset that she couldn't be this year with her beloved on Hanukkah to light the menorah. But Rabbi Steinzeltz turned to his grandmother and said, "Bubby, what's the matter?" And she said, "No, everything's fine." She said, "Bubby, did I not light the menorah properly?" And she said, "You lit the candles just fine." "Well, if I lit the candles fine, then what's the matter?" And she looked up and she answered, "You know, your grandfather used to dance after he lit the menorah. You lit the candles, but you didn't dance." And I love that story, because I think that's one of the issues that we may have in the Orthodox community, that I think being more involved in Kiruv can help with. We cross our T's and we dot our I's, but we often don't dance. Now, I used to think that to dance during davening, you either had to be Hasidish or a little strange. And there isn't, for those of you who know my family, I got one side Litvish and the other side Yeki. There isn't a bone in my body that would ever dance during davening. And when I started the beginner service here, in the other room, and I'd see people just getting up in the middle and just started clapping in the middle of like a regular song. I was like, you know, sit down. We're not clapping. We're not singing. I'm trying to keep... And in Manhattan also, years ago, people just would just stand up in the middle of things. They were just so inspired by something. I was like, let's just get through the davening. And there isn't a Shabbos that goes by now that we don't dance in the middle of our davening. And again, Yeki Litvak, there's no dancing here. But they wanted to dance. And I think this is so important to be reminded of how awesome and how joyous living a life of Torah is. And no one knows that better than someone who's been kept from it their whole life for one reason or another and has discovered it on their own. To meet someone who was raised in a more of a secular environment but who senses that there must be more to life, this can have such a profound impact on our community, on the community in which we are raised, going to shul every Shabbos and learning in yeshiva. We need to be inspired by the hislavos and the enthusiasm that is often associated with Balei Tshuva. And this is the Torah I wanted to share with you in memory of Rabbi Grimblatt, because there are really two aspects to Kiruv. What we in the Orthodox community can do for our less affiliated Jewish brothers and sisters, and what they can do for us. Just follow with me in the famous pasuk on the top of the sheet. This is the source for one of the Taryag mitzvahs to do kiruv lo sisna sachicha b'lvavecha. The Torah tells us it's the prohibition of harboring hate for a fellow Jew. Hocheach tocheach esamisecha. That's the source of outreach, to rebuke one's neighbor, to say something when you see a fellow Jew not acting, behaving consistently with Torah. V'lo tisa alav chet, and don't bear sin because of him. And all the Mefarshim ask the same question. What is V'lo tisa alav chet going on? What is it referring to? Again, the three clauses in this same pasuk. Lo sisna sachicha b'lvavecha, don't harbor hate. Hocheach tocheach asamisecha, reprove your neighbor, say something. V'lo tisa alav chet, and don't bear sin. What sin? So Rashi famously tells us, V'lo tisa alav chet, you can see Rashi, Lo salbin is panav barabu. What chet is it referring to? What sin? That don't bear sin? It's the sin of being, of embarrassing a fellow Jew, that maybe when you're trying to reach out to someone or you're correcting someone on their behavior, you see somebody who wasn't keeping Shabbos and you try to get them to be more connected, to become more observant, maybe, God forbid, you embarrass them in the process. So Rashi says, V'lo tisa alav chet is going on hocheach tochiach. It's referring to the mitzvah of tochacha, of reproving one's neighbor. And that is not a license for being malbish chaver barabim. Just because there's a mitzvah to do kiruv doesn't mean that there's any, that it's okay in any way to say something or do it in a way that would, God forbid, embarrass that Jew in public. But the Ramban disagrees. Ramban says, and follow with me on the left, Vayomer hakasuv al tisna sachicha bilvavecha. The Torah says, do not harbor hate for your fellow Jew. That's the opening phrase in the pasuk. Ba'asoso lecha shelo kirtzonecha. What does that mean? Don't harbor hate to someone when they do something against your will. Somebody offends you, somebody insults you, somebody does something that you didn't want them to do. Aval tochichenu. You should give him tochacha. The Ramban is saying, he's not looking at hocheach tochiach like we classically look at as the source for kiruv. He's saying it's talking about lo sisna. What is the only way to prevent yourself from harboring hate for someone else? You have to say something. You have to get it off your chest. The Torah says lo sisna sachicha bovecha. How do you prevent yourself from coming to hate someone who offends you, who does something wrong against you? So the Ramban is saying, you have to give him tochacha. You have to say something. If you don't say something, and you just let it fester, you're going to end up coming to hate this person. And you should give him tochacha. Madua kacha asisa imadi, the Ramban says. Why did you do this against me? V'lo tisa alav chet, and don't bear sin because of him. What sin? Lechasos sinato bilibech. to cover up the hate that's in your heart. V'lo sagidlo, by not saying anything. Ki ba'ochichacha oto, because by giving tochacha, yitznatzel lecha. When you give tochacha to someone else, you yourself become saved. What are you saving yourself from? The Ramban is saying, you're saving yourself from being over on the prohibition of losisna sachicha bilvavecha. This has nothing to do with kira. This pasuk, the Ramban is saying, this pasuk is about interpersonal human relations. The Torah prohibits us from harboring hate for a fellow Jew. And the Torah is telling us how you can prevent yourself from harboring hate. And that is, when you get offended, when something does something wrong, don't keep quiet. Say something. That's hochiach tochiach asamisecha. V'lo tisal avcheit, don't bear sin, says the Ramban. What sin? Osisna. The sin of harboring hate. So let me ask you, according to the Ramban, who is the primary beneficiary of hochiach tochiach asamisecha? Who is benefiting from this mitzvah? The person you're reaching out to? Or the person doing the reaching out, according to the Ramban? Person doing the reaching out. According to Rashi, it's classic. Rashi is saying, V'lo tisal avcheit is going rachiach tochiach, that when you're doing kiruv, make sure you do it in a sensitive way, make sure you do it in a way that doesn't, God forbid, bring embarrassment to a fellow Jew. And therefore, who's the primary beneficiary of kiruv? According to Rashi, it's the person you're helping, the person you're trying to bring into Shabbos, the person you're giving tochacha to. According to the Ramban, the primary beneficiary of this mitzvah is a person giving tochacha. Because by you giving tochacha, you are preventing yourself from being over on the lav, from violating the prohibition of losisna sachicha bilvavecha. And if you look at the Rambam, in two other places in the Mishnah Torah, and also in a Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam seems to endorse both of these. Which is it? Is it the Ramban or is it Rashi? And the Rambam says it's both. Take a look. Source number two. Let's do Halacha Zayin first, the second paragraph. Haroach Havero Shechata. If a person sees his friend that is sinning, or Shehalach B'derech Lotovon, he's going in an improper way. Mitzvah Lachzir L'Mutav. It's a mitzvah to bring this person to the good. Ulaodia Shuchote Latzmo, and to inform him that he's only sinning against himself. B'Masav HaRaim, through his behavior. Shinemar Ochiach Tochiach Samisecha. This is the way Rashi learns it. And hamochicha es chavero, when you're doing this, bein b'dvarim, bein shebeinu lebeinu, bein b'dvarim shebeinu lebeinu makom, whether it's you're giving tochacha in terms of a mitzvah that is in relation to himself, to your friend and his fellow human being, or it's between him and God, tzarech lochicha beinu lebein atzmo, you have to do it privately, v'daber lo benachas, and you have to speak benachas pleasantly, u'belashon raka, soft language. It's an art. Kiruv is not a skill. It's really a science, rather. It's really an art. And that's why a lot of the poskim hold that if you don't think you can be successful, or you don't think you have the ability to say something in the right way, you shouldn't do it. The Rambam is making a very important point. It should become clear when you're helping someone to become more observant that you're only doing this to help them, not because you're judgmental, not because you look down at them, they're less of a Jew than you, but because you care about them and you want to share the beauty of Torah that you have. But that's only one halacha in the Rambam. And that's the primary beneficiary is the person who's receiving the tochacha, because they're getting some Shabbos, they're getting Torah in their life. But if you look at the Rambam before, and halacha vav, kishiyechta ish li'ish, says the Rambam, when one person sins against the next, lo yistamenu v'yishtok, you shouldn't keep quiet. K'mo shenemar b'rishon v'lo diber avshalom en amnon l'meira v'atov, it's from Shmuel Bet, and Amnon, that avshalom got upset with Amnon, he didn't say anything. Ki sanei avshalom es Amnon. Rambam saying he hated because he didn't say anything. Here, his language is very similar to the Ramban's. Why did you do against me this and that? And why did you sin against me? So Kirov, says the Rambam, is not just trying to bring somebody closer to Yiddishkeit, it's also taking care of yourself, so you don't come to hate someone That phrase, Ochech Tochech Asamisecha, teaches two things. Our mitzvah to reach out and our mitzvah to say something when we are offended, to prevent ourselves from coming to hate a fellow Jew. And if you look at the Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam endorses this again on source number 3 on the bottom. Sivoy Shinitz Tavinu, Limchos Ba'ose Averav, Mishim Rotze, La Soso, La Zira, La Kach, Bitzvarim, La Chicho, Al Yomar Adam. Look at the third line, it's very powerful. Person should never say, Ani lo achte, I'm not sinning. Ve'im yechte zulati, and if this other guy, he sins, it has nothing to do with me. Ze inyano im Hashem. That's his business with God. Ze neger haTorah, says the Rambam. That is against the Torah. And by the way, that's why doing outreach is a very, very difficult thing. It flies in the face of our contemporary attitude, which is to not, you know, I don't think it's sticking our nose into other people's business. But it's everybody, it's a personal decision. Your religion is a personal decision. Of course it's a personal decision. And we are responsible for each other. And we could never take the attitude, this person's doing whatever they're doing. I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm not causing this person to sin. The Rambam says that callous attitude is neged HaTorah. Ela anu mitzavim, he says, mitzuvim, we are commanded shlo lavor v'lo nagiach luzulateinu mi'umateinu lavor. We are commanded not to transgress the Torah and also to help others. Umishirotza lavor chova kol adam l'chichu l'manu. It's our obligation. Look at the third to last line. Gam nechla b'mitzvah zu, included in this mitzvah, im heira ono zela ze, if somebody offends one person to the next, va'al mitor lo, va'al mishmor lo, lo chet, don't harbor it, eli nitztavinu lihitzraim ala b'tzvarim, you have to say something, kadesh lo yishar b'leiv klum, so nothing remains in your heart. And I share this Torah with you because if you see here, this is the two aspects of outreach. It's not just that the 85 to 90% of our American Jewish brothers and sisters need our Torah. Need the Torah, I should say. It's our Torah. But we also need them. We need their inspiration. On a very real and practical level, anyone involved in outreach knows that the questions that a beginner to Judaism poses, a veteran, pushes us to develop our own Yiddishkeit that much more. To be able to articulate and explain things that we've been doing our whole lives, that no one has ever asked us why. Why do you believe in God? Why do you believe the Torah comes from God? Now, these are difficult questions. But this is something that's missing from the Orthodox community. And we become more sophisticated in our own machshava when we are forced to answer other people's questions. And it can totally transform your Shabbos table. One of my host families, we send MGEers every Shabbos to families on the West Side. And once they told me, he says, you know, when we have MGEers at our table, you know, we feel a little more compelled to sing a Zemer. We don't always have Divrei Torah at the table. We make sure that somebody prepares a Torah. And we try to tone down the Lashon Hara a little too, you know, which doesn't always happen. But the biggest thing I think we can get out of being involved with Kiruv is ultimately the people that we meet. And this is what I want to leave you with. One final story. The extraordinary men and women that are just off the radar and whose spiritual journey is just so inspiring. If we don't engage in this work, we will never meet them. They will become lost to the Jewish people. And our lives will not be anywhere as enriched as our lives can be when we meet such special individuals, even if they don't completely turn their lives around. And I want to share one last story about one very special person who I just saw last week. And this is probably 12, 13 years ago, at the end of our beginner's meeting one Shabbos. One of the participants, his name is Mark Arkovitz. And he came over to me and he asked, where is the Chazan going with the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll? So he used to see them at the end of our davening. He used to see our Chazan take the Torah from the Aron Kodesh, and he'd walk out of the room. And I told him that he was bringing the Sefer Torah back downstairs to the third floor, because we were borrowing at the time one of the Sifrei Torahs of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side. And he looked at me, his name is Mark, he said, doesn't MG have its own Torah? And I said, no, we don't have a Torah. He says, why doesn't MG have its own Torah? So I said, well, I mean, it's very expensive, and you know, we're part of a big community. The shul downstairs has many Sifrei Torahs. They lend us one. Doesn't it say somewhere, Rabbi, that you're supposed to have your own Torah? You know, it can get a little annoying when your students actually start to learn something. And I said, yeah, technically it says you're supposed to write yourself your own Torah, but like, you know, we're one community and it's very expensive. I'm like, fumfrey. He says, well, you know, how much is a Torah? So I said, Torah can be very expensive. I mean, a brand new Sefer Torah could be $20,000, $30,000. It could take a sofer a year to write. He says, well, do you have to be like a holy person to give a Torah? And I looked at him and I said, Mark, I said, you're a holy person. and there he just blurted out. He says, I'll do it. I said, you'll do what? He said, I'll give MG a Torah. I said, Mark, it's a lot of money. I was a young guy. I was like 32, 33 years old. So he says, no, I have the money, but I'd like to do it in memory of my parents. I said, sure. I said, you sure you want to do this, Mark? I would love to have a Torah, but I want to do this. And I told him about this Hachnasa Sefer Torah, and I remember it was amazing. He was learning in our Chavrusa program on Wednesday nights, which is, thank God, very strong still. And his Chavrusa was a very learned guy we got him to learn with. He's a very smart guy. This Mark was a doctor, and he knew a sofer in Israel and commissioned the sofer in Israel. And it was this whole interesting thing, and it took about a year. And we had a Hachnasa Sefer Torah. And I asked Mark all along, do you want to speak at the Hachnasa Sefer Torah? It's your Torah. And he says, no, I'm a doctor. I'm not a public speaker. And we had Rabbi Schachter, who helped me start MGE on the Upper West Side, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, who's been a scholar in residence here many times over the years. And he got up to speak, and there were like 300 people there. It was a big to-do. And right before Rabbi Schachter got up to speak, Mark came over and he says, you know, maybe I'll say something. I said, sure. And Mark got up and he said, I just want to tell everybody why I decided to do this. When I say this, I don't mean the Torah. I mean become religious. So he said, last Yom Kippur, I wasn't going to come to synagogue. I only went to synagogue on the high holidays growing up. You know, and my father died when I was young, and he was a hero of mine. And my mother succumbed to cancer a few months before Yom Kippur, and I said, I'm not going back to synagogue. He was just angry. I was too angry with God. And then somebody schlepped me to MGE. Somebody literally came to my apartment, who was living in Manhattan, and said, you're a Jew, Mark. You got to come to shul. It's Yom Kippur. And just come for, we'll go, we'll stay for an hour, and you'll leave. I said, fine. And I went with him, and he brought him to MGE. And something clicked. And he came back the next Shabbos, and he's telling the story to the whole group on the Shnas Sefer Torah, and I came the next Shabbos and I took the basic Judaism class and I started to learn how to read Hebrew. And this was going on for a while, and I was a regular at the Beginner's Minyan. And Jessica, who was a regular at our Beginner's Minyan for quite a while, can tell you, we have a lot of different people who come. We get over 100 people every Shabbos. And you have some people who become Bali Tshuva and come, and some people who are traveling and are not becoming religious. It's a whole to mix. He says, so I was one of those people who came regularly. And, you know, the Cholent was good at the Kiddush. It's an attractive young crowd. What's not to like? It was great. But I'm going to start keeping Shabbos. That's a big deal. He says, but I had this one patient. And he, at the time, was a pediatric surgeon at Columbia Presbyterian. And he said that he was assigned to this 5-year-old girl's case. And it was a really nebuch. She had, unfortunately, a terrible prognosis. And I did something that as a doctor I'm probably not supposed to do, which is to develop a little of a connection with the family. She was from a Hasidic family. I'd never met a Hasidic Jew in my life, he said. And the family was so nice, and I felt so bad for them. And there was nothing we could do. And I would just pass by her room, and I would check in on her. And one night, as I was doing my rounds, I walked by her room, and I went in, and she was sleeping, the little 5-year-old girl, just very peacefully. And I sat at the edge of her bed, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, God, you know there's nothing we can do to save this little girl's life. But if you save her life, I'll start keeping Shabbos. Fast forward, he said, she survived, and now I'm a Sabbath observant Jew. Thank you all for coming to my party, he said. This is. And by the way, I just want to mention that I'm not saying that's our approach to Kiruv. We don't make those kinds of deals or cheshbonos with the Ron Shalom, obviously. He did. I'm sharing the story because of the unbelievable personality. Mark, at the time, was single, very eligible bachelor. He dated half the Upper West Side. And finally, he made Aliyah. He became a real hardened Tzioni. And he went to the Rambam Hospital in Haifa, where he became head of pediatric surgery. And his landlady set him up with the only other religious girl in the shchuna there, and they got married, and they just had their 5th child. Okay, he's now pediatric surgeon at Shaarei Tzedek. He moved to Yerushalayim. And I'm sharing this story because, you know, if we don't get involved in this kind of work, Mark Arkovitz, Dr. Mark Arkovitz, he's just another Jew out there. You know, he's a pretty unbelievable Jew. But there's just, the opportunities are amazing. And I just want to, in conclusion, thank you for inviting me to share this Torah and some of these stories in memory of my beloved Rebbe. And I mean this sincerely, and I cannot say this about anyone else. But if it wasn't for Rebbe Grumblat, that would not have happened. And none of the kiruv that I've been zocheh to be involved in the last 25 years, since I grew up in this very, very beautiful shul and community, would have happened without the mentorship and the absolutely love and affection and support that Rabbi Grimlock gave me for so many, many years. It should be Elias and Shem with him.
Thank you very much.